Acme is making your grocery shopping easier than ever. Download the Acme mobile app to find digital deals, earn reward points, or shop for delivery or pickup. Acme, fresh foods, local flavors.
93.3 WMMR, audio on demand, presents the Preston and Steve Show podcast.
Preston and Steve Fun Size Podcast.
Our next guests are here to promote a film which opens in January, and the theme is one that we've seen several times in the news: someone wrongfully imprisoned.
Yes.
Occasionally it happens where people are actually let out of prison eventually.
Just happened here in Philadelphia last week.
Yeah. And so we have it's very cool, the series of guests that we have here this morning. We have, first of all, the author of the book, Just Mercy, and the executive producer of the movie. It is his own story.
Yes.
So please welcome Brian Stevenson.
Yeah.
Brian, good morning. Thanks for being here. And we have stars of the film. Please welcome Tim Blake Nelson and Karen Kendrick.
Yeah.
Hey. To our studios. Great to have you guys here. We appreciate it. One of the things that we did not that long ago, Brian, was, you know, we've been together, this group, for 20 years, and I posed on the air, if there were to be a Preston and Steve movie, who would we be cast as? You have Michael B. Jordan playing you, sir.
Yes, and I told him, you have to have your Black Panther body when you play.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're going to be accurate.
A shirtless scene at some point.
If you're going to be accurate, you have to be totally jacked.
That's
There's just no two ways about it.
And I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, please, by all means.
But Karen, you play his wife in the film?
I play the wife of Jamie Foxx's character.
Of Jamie Foxx's character. Okay, all right. So I was going to say, you know, who's playing your wife in this film?
I don't have a wife.
You don't
Damn
have
it. A wife. Yeah. Well, you have to stick with what happened, so at least to some, you know, and you look very much like Michael B. Jordan. So
thank you.
So I don't know if you had anything to do with the casting, but did you just go through all the Marvel movies and just, you know, okay, I want Captain Marvel, I want the Doctor from Incredible Hulk, I want Black Panther.
Yeah, I wish I could claim that, but I'm so proud of the cast that we have. They're enormously talented people, and the important thing is that they bring to life the clients that I've represented, the people I've worked with. Tim is amazing as a really tortured person who was in prison but finally found a way to step up. And Kayron's performance is really remarkable because she embodies the struggle of a lot of people in this country who lose their loved ones to jail and prison unjustly. And it's a huge burden, and she brings all of that to bear in an amazing performance.
Well, Brian, we all want the pursuit of justice, and it's a major injustice when someone is wrongfully sent to prison. This is a case that has been, there have been many cases, obviously, with the revelation of DNA evidence and things of that nature. This is, you know, reading the aspects of the story, it appears outlandish that this person ever went to jail. Explain in a thumbnail what this story is about.
Sure. It's about an innocent man who was wrongly accused of killing a young white woman in Monroeville, Alabama, which happens to be the same place where Harper Lee grew up and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird,
which has many parallels.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And the irony was, of course, is that this community was very comfortable putting him on death row, convicting him for something he didn't do, even though he was with 30 other people when the crime took place who could all attest to his innocence.
It was like a church fish fry or something.
Exactly.
And there was actually a police officer at that event who verified he was there.
Exactly. He was convicted because people were angry. They felt like they had to get somebody prosecuted. And that fear and anger is what led to this wrongful conviction. But he was also convicted because he was poor. And one of the challenges that we have right now is we have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes.
Well, we've seen even people who are wealthy get bankrupt and have everything taken away because of the daunting legal costs involved with defending yourself.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, listen, everyone agrees. This is across the aisle. Everyone agrees that there's stuff that needs to be done.
Yeah.
We all, you know, all believe that people who are guilty of things should be held accountable. But when you hear stories of people who are away for years and years and years, you know, how do you give back someone a chunk of their, there's nothing you can do to rectify that. So you try. How did you get attached to this case?
Well, I started a project in Montgomery, Alabama, where we were committing to represent people on death row. Alabama doesn't have a public defender system, so we had a lot of people who were literally dying for legal assistance, and I wanted to respond to that need. And we slowly began building the project, and I just took on all of these cases. And Walter McMillan was one of the first cases that I worked on. And, you know, we're now at a point where for every 9 people who have been executed, we've identified 1 innocent person on death row. So it's still an enormous challenge to represent and to help thousands of people who've been wrongly convicted in our jails and prisons.
So you wrote the book. You wrote basically there was also, a children's version of the book that speaks to people who have family members incarcerated there, because there's collateral damage to every one of these things.
Yeah.
And then how does the process make the jump to the screen?
Well, I got contacted by some folks who said, we want to make a movie out of this. And I was very apprehensive, because you never know what happens when Hollywood gets involved. But there were some remarkable people involved. Destin, the director, and the studio execs have been very faithful to the story. They gave me a lot of input, which I was really happy about.
I think this is, you mentioned it's Destin Daniel Creighton?
Yes,
is that his name?
Right,
so his resume is not lengthy. But he's done some stuff. Was that a personal selection for you? Because he's the movie's getting raves, and they're commenting on he seems like a young director, but he seemed to embrace the material.
He did. He came with a kind of earnestness and sincerity. He made a film called Short Term 12, which I saw and I was absolutely blown away by, because he has a way of mitigating people who you might otherwise hate or distrust. Yeah. And that was important for me. I don't want anybody to think, I mean, my view is that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. And I want to have that expressed in this film. And he does a great job of pulling that together.
Huh.
Tim, you're a veteran actor. You've been in a lot of great films. And you probably get scripts all the time that you have to take a look at. Why did this one stand out amongst the others and seem like something you wanted to be a part of?
Well, I guess at this point, I only do stuff that feels irresistible. And this was that. First and foremost, because it's telling Bryan Stevenson's story. And this is a man who, we say, make a difference. He really, truly has changed, is changing what the justice system is in America right now. And so not only was it irresistible to be a part of telling this story, but I think we've all looked at it as a privilege. And that started with Michael B. Jordan taking on playing Brian. And it's true about Jamie and Rob Morgan. And Kayron is here. She can speak for herself. But this was one of those projects in which you simply felt you had to be involved.
Now, the gentleman you play is named Ralph Myers.
Yes.
And explain a little bit of what he is to the plot, to the story.
What he is in the plot is he's a guy who bears false witness, and in doing so helps put a man on death row. And he has to face how that ramifies.
Yeah.
It's really the Bryan Stevenson character puts the tragedy really right in front of him. And he has to face that in the context of his own tragedies that he's faced in a very traumatic life, having been a foster kid, having been nearly burned alive when he was 7 years old, and then having a justice system that threatened him with execution unless he testified falsely against this person of color.
It gets you knotted up just because there are a lot of people expect just black and whites in the world, and there are so many grays, and there are different textures to things, and you don't see what makes somebody who would do that and who has also had their own series of horrific things happen and the chain of events that lead to it. Is it, as an actor, is it a, how do you feel about when the person who's there, who is being portrayed, and you're interacting, do you seek them to say, can I get some insight? Or is that, as for you as an actor, a bit of folly to try to let that influence or inform your performance too much?
Anything that can inform is never going to be folly. In this specific case, I was not able to speak with Ralph Myers. I guess advised against that, although I think now, were we making the film now, that would be a different That would be, I would have had different advice.
Okay.
Just because of changes that have occurred in his life. What makes Brian Stevenson especially trenchant to me as a writer and thinker, and this is just personal to me as a white guy, is that he's explored in Just Mercy, and then Destin explores this in the movie, largely through the character I get to play, how the power structure in America exploits poor whites against people of color in pursuit of preserving hegemony, power. And it's something I never understood until I got to play this character and read Brian's book. How the power structure in America pits the poor against one another. And I think there's something to that. In sophisticated gray areas, it's not black and white, but I think it's there. And it was interesting to explore it.
I want to go back to something you said, Brian, because I'm confused by it. There is no public defender system in Alabama at all?
Yeah, that's right. Courts require poor people to have a lawyer appointed, but some states have tried to respond to that by just having private lawyers appointed for each person. We have a lot of states that have statewide public defender systems, but we have a lot of states that don't have that. And at the time this case was happening, appointed lawyers could only be paid $1,000 for representing somebody, even if they were facing the death penalty. And we estimate it takes at least 500 hours to prepare one of these cases. So lawyers were being asked to work for $2 an hour if they were going to do a good job. And, of course, lawyers can't afford to do that. And so what you see is lawyers going to court totally unprepared, not doing the investigation, not being able to make the right arguments. And that's one of the reasons why we've had so many wrongful convictions, is that we haven't invested in providing people with the resources that they need when they've been accused of something.
Is that at all changeable? Is it being changed?
There's a lot of work being done to try to expand the right to counsel, but it's a state-by-state decision. Criminal justice policy tends to be state-by-state, and that's the challenge. We have a lot of states that have just resisted investing in providing resources to people who are accused of crimes.
I'm a big believer in states' rights, but this seems an erroneous thing to allow to happen, because you need a vigorous defense. To me, I can't think of anything. We've talked about it on the show many times. Imagine you're wrongfully accused of something, and not only that, you have your freedom taken away, and no one will listen to you.
That's right.
I think nightmares generate from that.
And then you have the character that Karen is playing. So the wife of the man who's being wrongfully imprisoned. That's another level of insanity there. How did you take on that going into that? I mean, because we can't possibly imagine what that would be like, your spouse being held for something that they didn't do.
That he didn't do. And, you know, I feel like Minnie McMillan is a woman who had every reason to walk away, but she chooses to stand. Her husband is not guilty of this crime. She knows that. But he's made other choices that I think takes them into a gray area.
He's cheated on her.
Yes. Okay.
And he's been involved. So he's not a perfect person, but who is?
But who is?
Right. And mm-hmm. And so, but you know where, I don't know, somebody might be prompted to say, well, okay, he deserves this. But you have to, your character and the way you have to play it, you know, again, I've always said in the case of movies, you know, like if you take like a classic, this is a Bond movie, but a James Bond, the villains are more interesting when there's a certain point when you can go, I can kind of see that, you know, mm-hmm. so it makes it more, we can connect to this. And in the case, here's just a regular guy with warts and all, but he didn't do this.
He didn't do this. And I think that Minnie, kind of stands in the gap. I think that she is the person who to the community says, you know what? He's not perfect. He's human and he's flawed just like we all are. But we're still going to love him. We're still going to support him. We choose in this moment to stand by him for what is right.
Because right is right.
Because right is right.
Yeah.
And I think something else that Brian does so beautifully, when you read the book, you'll see this. And even in the film, he introduces us to the idea that we are all human. And even if we make choices that are not the best choices in that moment, we still deserve mercy. We still deserve grace.
Mm. On a basic thing, just cinematically, legal dramas. You talk about the great Gregory Peck and you know, mm-hmm. obviously, To Kill a Mockingbird. One of my favorite movies of all time is David Mamet's The Verdict.
The Verdict, yeah.
We're just drawn into it and drawn in, again, I think, because it incites something primal in us. This wrong must be righted, you know? And so it's your story, but there are theatrical things that have to be present to make it work. Was that a tough process for you to deal with?
Not really, because when you actually introduce something like the death penalty, where it's literally life or death, and then you have dynamics in these communities, a lot of people do not want me to kind of win this case. They do not want us to prove this man's innocence. And so I got bomb threats and death threats, and police pulled me over routinely. Because when you challenge something that never gets challenged, it disrupts things.
Yeah.
And that disruption can create fear and anger and resistance. And so that all adds to the drama of the story. And when you condemn people and you say their life has no meaning, no purpose, no value, such that we're going to take that life away, it just ups the stakes in ways that I think comes through in the film and through the performances.
When what time period was this? When did this take place?
So the crime took place in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. I was working on it in the early 1990s.
Okay.
You know, some things have changed, but a lot of things haven't changed.
Yeah.
In terms of we had, so Mr. McMillan actually got sentenced to life without parole by the jury. But our judges have the ability to override jury verdicts of life. And the judge in this case, whose name was Robert E. Lee Key, overrode the jury's verdict of life and imposed the death penalty. And that's how 25% of the people on our death row got theirs. They got life verdicts that were overridden by these elected trial judges. And so the politics of it was very real.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, there's a couple of things that I didn't realize that. Does the film clearly portray all of that?
It does.
Okay.
And that's what's great. You know, we've got just an amazing cast who bring to life all of these dynamics, and our team didn't really try to dumb down anything. You go through this process, you expect things are going to happen one way, and then when they don't, you deal with the real challenges of trying to advocate for people who are disfavored. And I think the performances make that a lot more accessible. When Ciaran has to bear the grief of her husband not being freed, and when Tim has to portray the complexity of whether you should stand up despite all of the repercussions, mm-hmm. people get a sense of what this is about.
This movie opens in January. Will that make it ineligible for the Academy, or?
It's actually opening on Christmas Day.
Uh-huh.
There you go. Right. There you go.
But if it's been shown in a theater,
that's all you got to do.
And I think the fact that you've appeared on this show makes it a shoo-in.
Well, that's what we were told.
You guys have a viewing last night? Was it last night for the Philadelphia Film Festival?
We were at the Film Festival last night.
And how was it received?
It was great. We had a wonderful response, and it's been great going around and hearing people respond to the film.
We're glad that the Philadelphia Film Festival is so awesome. And, and they're, I mean, it's now, you know, it's become a thing that really has some merit and gravitas, and we're all massive film fanatics, so it's great to be able to have people like yourselves in here to chat with us.
Thank you.
To switch gears for just a moment, so Tim, I wanted to ask you, because you've worked in all kinds of genres. This obviously of straight up drama, but we're also massive superhero film fans. I know that Marty recently beat up on him.
Martin Scorsese. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I know that you have The Watchmen coming up. And I'm excited for that, but you're playing a character I've never heard of before.
Looking Glass.
Yeah. And I read the novel, and I'm familiar with the film. I've seen it several times, but I wasn't familiar with Looking Glass.
Well, what Damon Lindelof has done is he's taken the 1985 graphic novel, and he's treated that as canon.
Okay.
It's almost just, it's absolute history. And he's projected its future 30 years forward, so it's now our present.
Ah.
And it's a parallel universe to ours, taking place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is a pretty unlikely place.
That's where you're from, isn't
that
it?
That is where I'm from, yes. Okay. And my character is sort of a psychological operations, a psyops detective.
Oh, wow.
And
that's awesome. I'm already on board.
He wears this mask that is entirely reflective.
Okay.
And he takes people into this pod to determine Truth and Lie, Guilt and Innocence.
Has Brian, why didn't you use that?
You could have gotten right down to it. All you needed is that mask.
But I can tell you people are going to be very excited about
it. We already are. We had Zack Snyder on a little while ago, and we're fans of the film. Yeah, and again, he's just massively wrapped up in this. So we're all working with bated breath, which you just told us made us very happy. So that's very cool.
Most definitely.
Can I ask about Buster Scruggs?
Yeah.
Scruggs. That was actually you singing in that.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. They wrote it with that in mind. Okay. Yeah. Because I had sung in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, you did in the jailhouse now, which is great.
Yeah.
Clooney didn't sing.
No, he can't sing. That guy can't. All he gets is the looks.
Yeah. And the acting ability. And the... that he radiates decency.
Lake Cuomo villa. Yeah. Yeah.
And a mall.
But you get to sing.
Yeah, but I get to sing and I get my radio face.
Join the club.
No, I just want to say to your fans that you are a handsome group. Staggeringly handsome. Oh. In fact, K-Ron and Brian and I, we don't even know how to be in your presence.
I want to ask K-Ron, right now I believe it's going on the female astronauts, the spacewalk. I know you're tied into NASA and Hidden Figures
We were just watching the footage live here a few minutes ago.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
we're doing it right now.
It's pretty wild. You continue to do stuff with NASA as well.
You know, when I went to when we were doing Hidden Figures, I created the Girls Empowerment Tour so I could really delve a little bit deeper into that entire world. Again, it was a story that I knew of, but I wasn't as familiar with. And so when I went to speak there, I was able to tour, and I was a kid in a candy store.
Oh, my God. It's got to be awesome.
Like Disney World. Yeah. I was like, oh, my gosh. And I of course, asked the questions that they probably hated, like, okay, are there really aliens?
You had to be the one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was an absolute blast, and we do still keep in touch.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm so excited that my friends are, these wonderful guys and astrophysicists, and I feel really important about that.
Tim, I wanted to ask you while we have you here about Minority Report. Are you ever surprised at the number of things that were in Minority Report that are now actually true?
My wife and I constantly talk about that. I think it's really like in its own way, 2001. Mm-hmm. There's so much of what Kubrick put in that movie that ended up being true. But that's what happens when you're involved with a great filmmaker. So Steven did his research and he talked with futurists, and not crackpot futurists, but really viable, informed ones. And I'm quite astonished.
I mean, I think it came out in 2001 or 2002, and looking back on it, it's still a great movie. Obviously, it holds up, but it's shocking at how many of those things are now present when it came out that many years ago.
Yeah, and that, of course, makes you expect that the aspects of it that haven't been achieved are just around the corner.
Yeah. Well, there's, in fact, Minority Report becomes sort of an expression of when people talk about the autonomous cars, and I say, when they have a Minority Report thing going on where all the cars are synced up and everything, mm-hmm. that's when it'll be, I think, viable. But the stuff that was predicted in it, it's just amazing to see.
Gattaca's another film.
Gattaca's
like
another one, and of course, 2001.
I just want to know when I can, before I'm entering a room, when I can roll a spider in.
Yes. Check everybody out.
Yeah.
Wow. By the way, I want to point out, we didn't mention this, that Brian graduated from Eastern University. Right here in the area.
Spent a lot of time on the main line.
What time frame were you living here?
That was the late 70s, early 80s, 77 to 81, but I was on the Paoli local all the time. And played Villanova and Swarthmore and Haverford and all of the mainline schools. And my mom grew up in Philly, so I feel really connected here. She grew up in North Philly. My grandmother lived in Germantown. My brother's still here in West Philly at UPenn. And so Philly's like home for me. It's great being back on the main line.
Wow.
Where'd you do your law school?
I went to Harvard.
I left.
I went to Harvard.
Yeah.
Oh, that
business.
Place.
Yeah. I went to Harvard twice.
Oh, yeah, two times.
Yeah. Well, the thing was that I was a philosophy major in college, and somebody came up to me in my senior year and said, "You know, nobody's going to pay you to philosophize when you graduate."
It's true. You never see a sign outside philosopher.
Exactly. And so I started looking into graduate schools, and I didn't know that if you want to do graduate work in history, English, or political science, you have to know something about history, English, or political science. And to be honest, that's how I found my way to law school. It was very clear to me, you don't need to know anything to go to law school.
Are you telling everyone that you're living your default plan?
It was certainly my default education. That's certainly true.
And films, when did that that realm even enter your mind?
You know, we've been really focused on narrative work here for the last 12 years. I'm a product of Brown versus Board of Education. I grew up in a community where black kids couldn't go to the public schools, and lawyers came into that community and made that possible. And about 12 years ago, I started worrying that we might not win Brown today, that we don't necessarily have a commitment to doing things that are disruptive on behalf of poor and disfavored people. Mm-hmm. And that's a narrative failing. We have to start telling the stories that get people to care more about the poor and the excluded and the disfavored. And so the book and the TED Talk and a lot of the projects we're doing now, we've opened a new museum in Montgomery and a new memorial. I hope everybody will think about visiting us in Montgomery to see these faces. But these are all narrative projects, and the film and storytelling is a critical way. We get people to think about things that they haven't thought about before. You know, that's what happened on the issue of domestic violence. We didn't really respond to women who were being abused until we started watching films like A Burning Bed that Farrah Fawcett made in the 70s, and we started telling those stories. And there are a lot of ways in which the film industry and storytelling can actually awake us to issues and concerns that we need to be alive to. And that's what we hope happens with this film.
All right, so this film, you said, it aired last night, and then it comes out officially before the year's up. But just here in Philadelphia, there was a gentleman who was wrongly incarcerated for 27 years.
That's right.
And so, obviously, there are parallels to what your story is about. But when I had heard... I don't know all of the details, but when I had heard just a couple of the details, like, I don't know how somebody, because when he came out, and this is just surface stuff, he looked like he was okay, right?
Yeah.
But, like, he lost the best 27 years of his life.
Yeah.
And how do you not go absolutely crazy? It almost feels like you've been muffled, and nobody can hear you. And how can a jury just completely dismiss one part of the testimony?
Yeah. Well, I think that's where the role of the lawyer comes into play. Mm. And we do have a lot of people who don't have the resources to get the kind of expert assistance that they need. One of the stories in this film involves a man named Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. Mm. And the reason why he was wrongly convicted is that he needed an expert who could prove that the gun they found in his mother's home was not the gun that was involved in these crimes. He didn't have that money, so he gets wrongly convicted. And so it is one of the challenges that I think we have to address. We've been pushing the creation of what we call conviction integrity units. We think every prosecutor ought to be open to investigating a case if there's evidence that the person is innocent.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a much better position to undo those wrongs than journalists or advocates or lawyers. And that's one of the things we hope comes out of this. But there's a real crisis. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, which probably means we have more innocent people in our jails and prisons than any place on the planet.
And I think the scariest thing about that is that any one of us is susceptible to this.
Absolutely. And people don't realize until they are accused how much money it takes to defend yourself. And
Talk about that earlier. It can devastate you. Simply the process of clearing your name. And at the end of it, you're left with...
That's right.
Well, you're clear now. Happy life.
That's right. And with things like mandatory sentencing, the consequences of even doing something wrong can be devastating. I'm representing people who are serving life without parole sentences for simple possession of marijuana, for writing a bad check for less than $100. And because of these mandatory sentencing schemes, we put people in prison for decades for things that are very minor. And so all of those things... It can complicate the way you have to approach these problems. And that's one of the reasons why we're so interested in generating a conversation about reform.
And that's what the film is planning on doing. I haven't seen it yet, but very excited. We have the premiere at the Philadelphia Film Festival. There's going to be a smaller release right before the end of the year, then opens wide in theaters. January 10th is the date that I have.
Yeah.
So we'll look for that. Well, listen, we appreciate your time. Thank you guys so much. And best of luck. Continued success. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you.
It was our pleasure.
It's here for Brian Stevenson, Tim Blake Nelson, and Karen Kendrick.
More podcasts from Preston and Steve available at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.